Well, so you can probably already tell that you're in the right place. This is 20 Questions with Steve Almond. I'm Henriette Lazaridis, and I'm the person asking some, but not all, of the questions. I have never played football, but to give you my sports bona fides, I have, sadly, sustained 3 concussions from soccer, so I know a little bit about what we're talking about here. I'm also a novelist. My debut novel, The Clover House, came out in April of 2013, and I think it might be out there for purchase and all that good stuff. So let's get started. First, though, I should remind everybody to please turn your phones off or silence them.
Or break them, even. You become more attentive
to
the world around you.
Give them to the people in the back. I also should say that the signing, you couldn't have missed it, that Steve, and I guess I, will be signing books outside, just in that area right outside the door, once the session is over. And the way we're going to work the session is we'll start the conversation off with some questions that I have for Steve, and then leave time for you to ask questions that you have in mind. Little introduction here. Steve Almond has authored 10 books and short story collections, including My Life in Heavy Metal, Not That You Asked, Rants, Exploits, and Obsessions, and the New York Times bestselling Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. His work has also appeared in the Wall Street Journal, GQ, and the Best American Short Stories 2010, and has been awarded a Pushcart Prize. Almond has taught writing at his alma mater, Wesleyan, and at Boston College, Emerson, Ohio State, the Tin House Writers Conference, and Grub Street, among other places. And he now teaches narrative writing for the Nieman Foundation for Journalism. Additionally, Almond is a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine and to the Rumpus, where he originated the role of Sugar for the Dear Sugar column. He now dispenses witty and insightful advice on virtually everything in his heavy metal column for WBUR's Cognoscenti. Almond's newest work is, as you know, Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Since its publication at the end of August, Against Football has become the center of a lively and sometimes heated debate about America's most popular sport, a debate waged everywhere from fan forums to The New Yorker. Booklist called Against Football brilliantly quotable, carefully constructed, and an emotionally vulnerable tract, and a searing, thought-provoking book. It's interesting to me, you can actually sustain physical harm, blistering, searing, from reading Steve's work. Newsweek had this to say. In his 11th book, Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto, Almond launches a devastating, multi-pronged attack against what he sees as the sins endemic to the sports business. And today, we get to continue this debate with the man himself. I give you Steve Almond.
Hi.
So I actually wanted to just start with something that you wrote in Candy Freak. That seems to apply to much of your work.
Okay.
There's a theme. I mean, the fans, fanaticism, obsession is a theme.
Yeah.
And you say in Candy Freak, we may have no conscious control over our allegiances, but they arise from our most sacred fears and desires, and as such, they represent the truest expression of ourselves. So what is that truest expression of ourselves or of yourself that is revealed when we are passionate about sports, but specifically football?
Well, football, I think, has a lot to do, for me anyway, had a lot to do with connecting to the world of men. I'm always struck, especially when I talk with female fans of football, and I say, how did you come to football? And they don't always, but they almost always say, well, it was to get time with my dad. It was a way to connect to my dad, or sometimes to a boyfriend or a spouse or a brother. And that's how I think people, you know, people aren't just born with a little Patriots helmet on. They, like any other thing that you have an allegiance to, you know, you're sort of trying to fit into some culture. And I think with football, it's a really tribal kind of brotherhood. For me, when I grew up in a house with two brothers. I had a twin brother and an older brother, and we were fighting all the time. And by fighting, I mean like psychological, emotional fighting, and also physical fighting, quite cruelly, I think, as a result of certain weaknesses and insecurities and that's the thing, the mic thing. And I think football is one of those sports that provides a kind of context where violence is not only acceptable, but actually heroic. There's a lot of wonderful sports in the world, but football is endemic to it, is the idea that at a certain point you have to hit somebody and be hit by somebody. You have to quietly absorb and inflict punishment. That's part of the kind of heroic nature of it.
Is there then a difference between hockey and football?
Yeah, there's a difference between hockey and football. There's a difference between every sport and football.
Why?
Because hockey, there's staged and ritualized violence in hockey. There's a wonderful new book out called Boy on Ice by John Branch. It's just fantastic, and it's about a guy, an enforcer. They stop the game, and they have this, and that's a ritualized thing, one player on one player. It's like the Greeks. The guys go out in front of the line to fight one another on behalf of the armies. It's a ritualized thing. It's nothing new. And that's one participant who's designated as the goon. And there are incidental hits against the boards.
Yeah, checking.
Incidental hits against the boards. Football is every single play, there are at least a dozen serious collisions. That's just the way it works. If you're a lineman, if you've ever played, how many people have played football in this audience? Okay, will you vouch for me, gentlemen, that there is a hit on every single play, that there are a number of collisions? They're not concussive hits. It is possible to play football safely from cradle to grave. It's not that everybody who plays football is going to suffer some kind of neurological damage. You don't necessarily. It's that endemic to the sport, and there are collisions every single play that are really the most dangerous. It's not the big concussive hits that wind up leading to neurological damage. It's the buildup of the hundreds and even thousands of subconcussive hits. And that's what marks football as distinct from any sport. It's extremely violent. Anybody who plays it, especially today, and yet it is not considered a blood sport. The reason Americans turned away from boxing is because the violence and the brutality of it was too overt. We saw blood. We don't frequently see blood in football. What we see is young men at the height of their powers colliding and so forth. And if they get carted off the field, we feel bad for a second. And I believe we kind of pornographically consume the play in which they were hurt over and over and over again. And then the game goes on. Would you agree? The game goes on.
What about people who, I mean, if football is the most popular sport in America, and that popularity includes people who watch while staying in the room for the commercials and walking out when it's not the commercial, or who use it as a vehicle to just have a conversation around the chips and dip.
Yep.
And so is it not possible then to just enjoy football without the desire for the violence and the kind of subliminal
need to... Yeah, there's two questions there. I mean, part of what I'm trying to figure out in the book is, why do I come to football? Why has it become so important to me? Your original question, you were saying, so what is it about our obsessions that represent who we are? And the answer is, you know, if you investigate whatever you're obsessed with, there's a deep reason why your mind is snagged on it. Obsession is one of those verbs that combines desire with a kind of self-destructive obsession. It connotes an internal conflict. You're hung up on something. Mm. You should move on. But in fact, children, how many people have children, young children, are they not obsessive from birth? All my kids are obsessive, and they go through phases where they're absolutely fixed on something. I think obsession is the actual default setting for our personalities as human beings. And I think we're taught out of it and instructed out of it because it's impolite, it's inappropriate, and so forth. With football, the obsession for me, and I think for most fans, if they're honest, doesn't just have to do with grace and athleticism and beauty and intricacy and strategic density, all of which football has in spades. It has to do with the fact that something is at risk, that people's bodies are at risk, and that gives the game a certain kind of buzz that other sports don't have. And that buzz is part of the reason that it really dovetails with the American mindset. Look at our culture, folks. Can we agree that we have by far the most violent popular culture of any industrialized nation, and the highest incarceration rate, and the highest gun ownership? We are swimming in a pornography of violence. And what football is normalized, sanctioned violence. And it's also a beautiful game that I love. So I'm trying to say, I know I can get up on a soapbox. I love it. My book is an attempt to struggle with the fact that I love this game. I love watching it. I come to it honestly. But part of the reason if I'm totally honest with myself, part of the reason is because I grew up in kind of a jungle. And my brothers and I were always beating the hell out of each other in various ways. And I wanted to be brave and to see courage on display and to see a beautiful, to see that chaotic aggression transmuted into a beautiful, intricate game. And that's what football does.
You talk in the book about the sort of the variable reinforcement schedule, that which is what I think of as why a dog keeps coming and sitting, because the dog thinks every time you're going to give the dog a treat, and sometimes you don't. And it's like every time you watch a football play, here's the question: are we hoping to see the collision and we're disappointed when we don't, or are we hoping to see the player break free and do something majestic?
And it's a beautiful question, and the answer is both of those things. You know, I love watching Barry Sanders play football, because Barry Sanders created with his body miracles out of a complete ruinous, chaotic, massive bodies, all attempting to concuss him severely, if not snap his ACL in two. He alone sees an aperture of possibility and is able to execute it with his body. And he suddenly breaks free, and out of that chaos, it's just Barry Sanders with nothing between him and glory but green grass. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's part of the excitement of it. But it's also true that football is become super popular because it also involves risk. These guys are putting themselves at stake. When you're at a football game, there are a few noises, there are a few events that provoke a big limbic response from the audience. One, as you suggested, is a big play where somebody breaks free and they're running, and you know, suddenly, or there's a big pass play or a score, blocked punt. But the other thing that is the most striking, if you've ever gone to a live football game, is when there's a really big collision. And what happens? Ooh! It's not even a conscious response. The audience, the fans, have this instinctual response to say, oh my gracious, something real just happened. Something to jolt us out of the neurasthenic haze of our lives, our risk-free lives.
But that's the same response we would have if we saw our child or someone else's child fall down. We would, oh my goodness. And then in a stadium, usually that big ooh is accompanied by silence. To be fair, you
know, yes.
People are worried.
And then
you see the shots, you know, the camera pans around the stadium and people are like this and they're actually worried.
And then what happens? That's absolutely right. And then what happens?
And then
he's carted off and the game goes on. But before he's carted off, and I love it, let's mix it up. If people disagree, let's get into it. And then what happens is that the play is replayed over and over and over again. And the TV, the network, and by the way, there are parabolic mics on the sidelines so that you can hear the bone-crushing impact. What's happening? What are we up to, folks? If we're so horrified by it, if we're so dunned by this sudden acceleration into violence, why do we watch it over and over and over again? And to what extent is that same impulse at play when we see a video of Ray Rice punching his girlfriend? Her brain suffers a concussion. A dozen players on an average NFL day suffer the same kind of thing. Their brains are concussed and they're knocked unconscious. When it happens there, we ooh and ah, but we're not outraged. In fact, secretly, if that guy wasn't on our fantasy team, we're sort of happy that he's out of the game, or if it means that our team has a better chance of winning. It's not an effort to say we're all just evil beasts. The book was my effort to say, what am I up to exactly? And what is this sport up to? And what are the things that we consent to in watching this sport that we're not thinking about or feeling about?
You write, obviously, at some length about the NFL's feeble, we won't characterize them, the NFL's efforts to deal with the concussion problem in the sport.
Right.
And is it safe to kind of sum it up and say that you would like the players to assume far less risk and the owners financially to assume more?
Well, certainly that would be lovely, but the intention of the book is to say, I love this game. It's really, they call it a manifesto, and it was named against football because they wanted to sell fucking books, basically. Sorry, I didn't say that. That's my punishment. But it's really more of a lamentation. It's not a manifesto. It's saying, how can you step away from something that you love, and how can you recognize the parts of you that are probably loving this thing for the wrong reasons, And, you know, Americans don't like to interrogate their pleasures. They really don't. We want to have bacon, but we don't want to visit the slaughterhouse or think about the slaughterhouse existing. So my goal isn't to change the NFL. It isn't even to lead a boycott. It's to force other fans to be in the same state of moral struggle that I've been in, and then let them make up their own minds, honestly. They might decide. So I'm not interested in sort of saying, well, you know, the owner should. It's like, it's obvious that the NFL, like any other large corporation, is just a nihilistic, it's a machine that converts. It converts our devotion to athletic heroism into an engine of nihilistic greed. That's what the NFL does. It's what the NCAA does as well. But that's just business as usual. That's just capitalism. Of course they don't have a conscience. Of course all they care about is continuing to generate revenue. That's their job. So sort of treating the NFL like a morally responsible actor is ridiculous. They're never going to do that because they're a corporation. It is incumbent upon the fans to have a conscience and to exercise that conscience in relation to the game, and then to make whatever decision they want. And by the way, the owners, are you going to get a guy like Jerry Jones who plays by those rules, or any of these guys who are billionaires? Do you honestly, can we sit here in Boston in 2014 and expect that their motives are going to be pure as the driven snow? How do you think they got so rich?
So then isn't that the case for regulation or altered policies and laws surrounding the building of stadiums and the compensation of players and the compensation of other ancillary parts?
Yes, certainly that could happen. The government could come in and try to regulate. OSHA could say, geez, 30% of your workforce is going to get brain damage? That doesn't sound right. There's no other context, workplace, in which we would accept that. We're going to come in and regulate. Or the legal system will eventually have its toll there. But the real point of the book is, we built it. The football industrial complex belongs to us. And the media does a great job of trying to insulate fans from their moral responsibility. Blame Ray Rice, blame the owners, blame Roger Goodell. Nonsense. We gave them power. We were the ones who gave them that power. We continue to give them power. If Bob Kraft tomorrow threatens to move the Patriots down to Hartford, he will basically rely on the sentiment that we desperately want the Patriots so much that we're willing, like the people of Minnesota, to pay $500 million in public funds to keep the team. Or New Orleans, where they paid $1 million. Or Baltimore, where they paid $200 million and gave Art Modell that stadium for 30 years rent free, thereby quintupling the value of his franchise. Do you understand? We're the consumers. And you asked that question about, can't we just watch the game sort of in a state of, like, we won't even watch the commercials or the violent parts? We're not just fans. We're the sponsors of the game. Without us, the game actually doesn't exist. We're the reason that it's the most popular sport in America by a factor of five. It's kind of on us.
Well, actually, what I mean is that it's not that we're seeking to insulate ourselves from the violence of the game, but I think that a lot of people who consume the game don't really consume it in the way that you're saying.
I would say that if that's the case, I wonder why they're not drawn to an equally strategic game that's less violent. I mean, I see your point,
sure,
but I think that part of my sort of journey was saying, like, why do I like football in particular? Yeah. Why did I get a charge when Daryl Stingley was paralyzed by Jack Tatum? Why did I continue to watch that game, though at 11 years old I knew that a sport, consuming as a form of entertainment, a sport in which I saw somebody paralyzed in front of my eyes, was probably not the morality that I or my family system or even my culture wanted me to have, since it's essentially sociopathic.
To be fair, I mean, and I don't want to be an apologist for the NFL in their behavior toward concussions, but isn't it, it is kind of, what, within the last 15 years that sort of people, your average person has a greater awareness of concussions, wouldn't you say? I mean, I think when I was growing up, nobody talked about concussions. I mean, how many people in this room have had a concussion? It's a lot of people, actually. How many of you feel that you know what a concussion looks like, what causes a concussion, all that stuff? Not a lot of people. Not a lot of people. And I think as a culture, And we're, sadly, we're way ahead of FIFA, the soccer governing body.
Right. Well, let me say a couple things. One, and the NFL doesn't have a concussion problem. It has a violence problem, and it has, let me put it more fundamentally, it has a physics and physiology problem, okay? Mm. The brain is a soft organ. It's in a hard shell called your skull, and mass times acceleration equals force. And as players have gotten bigger and stronger and faster, they're colliding with greater force, and it's not the big catastrophic hits that cause the long-term neurological damage. It's the accretion of these subconcussive hits. They did a study out in Purdue, and because I want to kind of put to rest the question about concussions. Not that it isn't important and they don't have an impact, but it's not what we're really talking about here. They did a study out in Purdue, and they tested like, oh, well, high school football players are getting concussions. We should see what the neurological effects are, the effects on their brain function. So they put monitors on 24 players, and they wanted to get a control group, a bunch of kids who'd never suffered a concussion. So they got a control group. And then they did their testing. How are their brains doing over the course of the season? Here's where it got complicated, as my nephew would say. The control group, the kids who had never suffered a concussion, were showing diminished brain function. Serious enough that by the end of the season, some of those kids had no function in their frontal lobe, the part responsible for moral reasoning, among other things. I want you to think about that. If that had been a gas leak in the cafeteria of that school that caused diminished brain function in our high school students, how quickly do you think parents, school officials, legal officials, the government, lawyers would have descended to shut down that school and quarantine it? Very quickly. But because it's within the context of football, our response is entirely different. It's not that concussions don't matter and aren't a real problem, especially second impact concussions, where the brain can hemorrhage and you can die rather quickly. But it's the slow buildup. And as for the NFL's role, they have done everything they can to cover this up. The basic business model of the NFL is we are going to provide a spectacle so thrilling to you, and NCAA as well, with some free labor thrown in on their cases. We're going to provide a spectacle so thrilling that you will not think about the moral hazards of this game at all. That's how enjoyable football is. We won't think about the economic moral hazards, the hazards in terms of our suppression of empathy, the way in which violence is normalized, militarism is normalized, our gender roles. We accept the toxic gender roles of the NFL. If you're a female, if my daughter watches football, she sees women who are sexual ornaments, who jiggle on the sidelines, and men who are big and strong and are effective in the world and have power and status by being aggressive. That's what she sees. And then we act shocked when that attitude somehow is expressed off the field.
We had a question from, well, it was from somebody through from Twitter about what do you do about the fact that football offers a path to either financial stability or education in some cases, and or both.
Yeah, you know, to certain kids.
To certain kids. So you know, all these risks. There is some reward for some players, so what do you do about that?
This is going to get dark very quickly. This is the most cynical arrangement of the whole thing. Because when we say certain kids, can we be honest for once in fucking in America? Can we just for once, sorry. When we say certain kids, we mean kids from economically vulnerable neighborhoods, and we mean usually kids of color. And here is what we say to them. We do not really, honestly, give us truth serum or just put us alone in a room with no mics. We do not care about the content of your character. That is of no worth to us as a culture. Your academic development is purely ornamental. Your moral system isn't even especially complicated as long as you stay out of the headlines. What we need from you is to be ready on game day to bust some heads. And we will do whatever we need to do to get you there, because that's how much we love our game. That is monstrously cynical. That arrangement that we consent to and endorse is extraordinarily cynical. It is the plantation mentality.
Would you argue that the players or the players' parents aren't properly consenting to that arrangement?
I think actually my experience, I have a long chapter in the book about Liberty City, where I spent a long time doing, some years ago, doing an investigative story. That actually, that culture, they have agreed to the idea that football is the pathway out. It's the path to economic salvation. They have inculcated that idea. And the arrangement is not only deeply cynical, but it's also super inefficient, because one in 500 kids who plays high school football as a senior is going to make it in the pros. He'll be in the pros for about 3.5 years. He'll be out in several years after that. He'll probably be broke. That's the arrangement. And that leaves, I'm doing the math here, 499 other kids for whom the things that they really need, schools, support for working parents, at real decent wage jobs and so forth, is not even on the table. And football is a part of that. The idea that this myth, this containing myth that it's a pathway to economic salvation for certain kids, is one of the ways that we justify not creating real equality of opportunity in our culture. If football were gone and we could no longer say that, we might start to look at the fact that this country's wealth system is kaplooey. It's insane, the inequality of opportunity that we consent to. And football is a part and parcel of that. And that line about, well, certain kids, because honestly, the colleges don't care. They just, it's a business that somehow has infiltrated our educational system. If somebody wants to, from this audience, wants to explain to me what a violent, thrilling form of entertainment is doing as the leading signifier of our higher education system, I'm all ears. I have no idea why and how we consent to that arrangement. It seems to me utterly degrading to the true purpose of high school and college, which is to improve people's minds and, I hope, their moral systems, and maybe even foster greater empathy within them. Communist that I am.
Remind me, and what is your stand on the Northwestern players unionizing?
I think it makes a lot of sense if you run the risk of permanently injuring your body and potentially permanently injuring your brain to get paid. Mm. Since these guys, anybody played in college at any level? It, especially now, these guys work 40 or more hours a week. Any other context on earth in America, we would call that a job. Everything that they have to do, all the training that they have to do, not just during the season, but in the off season. To be at the highest level of this sport, because it's become so insanely lucrative and competitive, you have to spend an unbelievable amount of time and energy just learning the playbook, keeping your body healthy, practicing, learning, traveling, dealing with media, recovering from various injuries. I don't think people really understand what football players go through, what their lives are actually like.
And they're very insulated from their peer group. Their peer group becomes a pocket of people who are insulated from the rest of the university and the rest of their hometown. And
well, they're lionized by their hometown, but they're very quickly, if you're a good football player, anybody who's a young player, who's a good football player, you're very quickly segregated. Part of the reason it's difficult for them to interact is because they live in a world that's a really tough, macho world. This world, it's motherless. It's a motherless world. You've got a coach who's a stern dad and instills some good virtues, but you do not have a mother figure.
Slightly shifting gears. I mean, you say that the rise of football in this country is an indicator of our increasingly bloodthirsty self-identity. And so that assumes that we can quantify bloodthirstiness over periods of time, which let's go with that. And this sounds like a flippant question, but it isn't really. I mean, couldn't you say also, this has also been the rise of a cappella. the same period of time in which there's been a rise in the popularity of football, there have been numerous other non-bloodthirsty things that have become immensely popular, like
yes,
cooking shows and
yes,
singing shows.
Yes. And I will turn my mind to them eventually, but the sport I'm writing about is the most popular thing in America. Part of the reason that I wanted to write this book was to work out my personal thing. And to what extent I was successful, whatever, I don't know, I tried. But it's also true that it's the biggest narrative in America. When an a cappella show or a cooking show or a show about anything, it, you know, is at the top of the ratings, I don't know, 120 out of the top 121 television shows last year was a football game. What we pay attention to in America, what we vote for with our attention and our love, and our, that means something. It has deep meaning. Football isn't just some form of entertainment. It's a huge industry, and it's also a big part of our spiritual lives and our communal lives and our civic life. And that means it bears investigation, not as a form of entertainment, but as a moral undertaking. It means something. It's so much bigger than religion at this point. I mean, I was at a UU, you know, the little UU church we go to, no surprise, I'm sure. And I was sitting there, you know, the pastor was making a very, like a lovely sermon, and he made one joke. Then, you know, people were kind of listening, sort of half listening, and he made one joke about the Patriots, and suddenly, zoop, everybody was awake, and everybody had something in common, something that they believed in, something that they turned to on Sundays to feel a greater sense of themselves or to feel exalted in some way. And I thought, boy, how many people are in a church on Sunday giving, how many hours are given over to a real, I'm not joking, as an atheist, I really mean this. How many people give over as many hours thinking about the presence of God in their life, whatever God means to them, and what they're doing here and how we got here and what our responsibility is to imagine the suffering of others versus feeling something deep and meaningful about football. And I think the answer is like football's winning and it's not even close. And that means that we have to look at that, or at least part of my job, I take it to be, as a writer, is to try to look at that.
It's interesting, too. I mean, when people snapping to attention at the reference to the Patriots, it's almost like it's the thing that you can feel you can snap to attention to, even if you're not that big a fan, because right. It's sort of, okay, it's when you go into the hardware store, you say, hey, how about those Red Sox?
Right.
I might say that when I really couldn't care at all about the Red Sox, but I might have said that, because right. It's okay to like the Patriots, or as my father, my Greek immigrant father, used to call them, the Patriots.
The Patriots.
Without understanding anything about football, he'd be like, oh, the Patriots are playing.
And in fact,
there you go, it's unifying.
And in fact, it's super significant, because a lot of the reason that particularly your immigrant father would connect is it is a way in.
Right.
If you think about football and the values that it fosters and what it's really about, it's like capitalism, it's like America on steroids. It's incredibly specialized. It's strategically really dense. The marketplace is super hyper-competitive. It's all on public display. It's dangerous. It's thrilling. That is a description of the way that our culture has turned in terms of our business ethos and to some extent our kind of social ethos. How many clicks will I get and so forth? And, you know, for immigrants, it was a way to immediately feel that you were, sports, athletics in general, a way to immediately feel like you were part of this big chaotic American fabric. And that's what I think, especially as our civic institutions like religion and our family lives and even our sense of geographic and civic identity fade, what's left are giant stadiums and our sense that we're at least all part of some tribe, right? And that's what this pastor was hitting on unintentionally was, oh, yes, we all are a part of that. We know that narrative. And that's what Americans, I think, are desperate for. We're getting lonelier and lonelier, and we want something that we can all plug into.
You, in Against Football, you talk about fanaticism, obviously, in fandom, but you don't use the term drooling fanatic for yourself. So drooling fanatic, would you like to explain the drooling fanatic?
It's like an overweening, embarrassing form of being a fan.
Which,
like,
comes from your book,
The Rock and Roll
Book.
Yeah, so like, I don't know if other people are like this. I think actually everybody is like this about something. There's just something that you care about to an embarrassing extent. And maybe it's a website or a television show or, I don't know, it's something, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe a movie star or a sports team. And that term is just meant to describe like an allegiance that is actually almost limbic and embarrassing. Like, you can't control it. I see the silver and black, or I see the word Oakland, and I just go, bing, and like, I can't stop myself.
Just a couple questions away from football before we open it up to the rest of the audience. You have obviously written a tremendous amount and published a tremendous amount, and you're often on the radio speaking, and as well as on
BigBar's
website and
yep.
drooling. And I believe that we've talked about this, that you are very insistent on being compensated for your content, for your content creation, for your work, in a way that not all writers are. A lot of writers write for free.
Yeah.
And you feel very strongly about this, and I'm wondering if you can address that.
I actually write plenty for free. Everything I did for the Rumpus, which was a lot, was for free. And part of the reason I loved writing for the Rumpus was because I could say what I want in the way I wanted. I didn't have to come up with some hook. I didn't have to tie it to some friggin' TV show. I actually am happy to work for free if nobody's making money in the deal. When I'm not so happy to work for free is when I know that somebody else is making money off of my labors. And that has to do with the basic idea that it's hard to write. It's hard to be an artist of any kind, but it's hard to write. You got to make a lot of decisions all in a row when you're choked with doubt. And that labor should be esteemed and it should be rewarded. I make these little DIY books and I charge people that they don't have ISBN numbers. I just sell them in person. And it's a little awkward to be like, yeah, I need to ask you now for $10 like a drug dealer. But it also is trying to send the message, I worked on this, it's worth something. It is worth something. My labor is worth something. I once got an email from an agent, which is already a bad start, and he wanted me to write something for free. And I kept saying to him, I said, sure, I'm happy to, it sounds great. What's the economic arrangement here? And he kept sort of avoiding my question. I was like, dude, if you want me to do it, tell me what the economic arrangement is. I actually, online, this email exchange exists and you should find it. It's like capitalism in 2 minutes. Anyway, he finally admitted that he was getting an advance of $50,000 for this book. And larger advance, the advance for Against Football was like $5,000, okay? Just to put it in scale. That's a lot of money for a writer to get paid.
So he was getting it, but you were not going to get.
And he was objecting to the idea that the people who provided the writing for the book should get paid. And I just kept saying to him, dude, are you crazy? It is degrading to what we're trying to do as writers. And he had all these excuses, whatever. He just did a soft shoe at that point. I felt like, go on Fox News. They can use your, imbecilic projection. I mean, he really had a whole tap dance.
What about people who don't have the choice to write for pay?
Well, then everybody should make that decision as their own conscience recommends. I don't have a lot of power in the writing world. Actually, nobody does, except for like five writers, all of whom are wonderfully talented and deserve that. I have nothing but admiration and envy for them. But most writers are in a pretty powerless situation. I kind of a little bit, because I'm, sort of known in a little mid-list way, can be like, I would actually like to get paid if it's all right, sir. Because just think about it. That's fair practice. Writing is not something you just do and it's like a hobby. For some of us, it's my sole means of supporting my family with many children that I can't even keep the track of the number, but they all have to eat, okay? So, my wife and I have a different attitude about this. You have to have a patron if you want to be a writer. And that means sometimes a patron's the academy, but for me, it's all the various editors and different projects I work on. So if they're making some money, I want a share of it. I don't want like an unfair share, but I want a little bit.
Well, let's open it up to questions. Gentleman in the pale blue. Yes.
Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay. I have an answer and a question. Steve, you posed the question of how is it that higher education embraced football in such a huge and fantastic way. I think you would have gotten to the answer if you kept going, which was money.
Right. In fact, there's an amazing book. I want to let you ask your second question. There's an amazing book called The Opening Kickoff by a guy named Dave Rivesign, in which he writes about the origins of football in this country. And he tells this amazing story about the University of Chicago. That school, because they recognized back in the late 1800s, that football was a great way to promote the school and to make money. Before they'd even built the school, the president had hired the most famous coach in America, Amos Alonzo Stagg, to build that, and they didn't even have doorknobs on the buildings on campus. So we think all these things are new, but in fact, they've known for a long time that this is a way to build the brand name of your school. Sorry.
And I do think the field is still named the Amos Alonzo Stagg Field, I think. My question was, you had said that we are all have all sort of given permission and motivation to
sponsorship
to those powers that be to do this. Well, I haven't read your book, sorry, But maybe
what?
Maybe you give.
How are you allowed in the room? Okay.
Maybe you'll give the answer in the book. What are we to do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I do try to provide some answers, but the central answer is that. I mean, my role in writing the book, what I was trying to do is, I didn't know that much about football. I know I loved it. I didn't know that much about the economics of it. I hadn't thought that deeply about the attitudes that it fosters. So I wanted to set out a full accounting of both the game's allures. I spent a couple chapters talking about why it's so beautiful, why it appeals to Americans in particular, and so forth, and why I loved it as a fan and what it is to be a fan. And then also its moral hazards. Because I think if people really knew, for instance, that the NFL is tax-exempt, or that 70% of the funding for stadiums comes from you, the taxpayers, I think they would have a different attitude towards it. Or if they knew that the NFL had spent years trying to falsify industry data, research data, in order to cover up the link between the sport and brain damage, I think it would cause a kind of awakening. And the other point that the book is trying to make is, you're a sponsor. The reason that the NFL gets $5 billion in TV revenues is ultimately because you are sitting on a couch passively consuming that game. What you can do, I think, is recognize that and recognize that the fans actually ultimately hold the power, and then do as your own conscience recommends. That might mean organizing, that might mean trying to get your city to pass a law saying that you're not going to provide public funding for any athletic stadium or facility in which the investment is not returned to the taxpayers. It might mean you might push for weight limits so that players aren't bulking up. The average high school player in a big program in Texas, the lineman weighs 305 pounds. That's bigger than the pros weighed. How much did they weigh, the heaviest player in your time when you were playing? I assume you're like 29 or 30. Yeah. How? I'm serious. How big was the biggest player? Yeah. They were, because they were playing at their normal weight.
Right.
If you read this book...
And they were playing two ways, maybe, right?
Playing two ways, but also just playing at a normal weight. What's happened because the sport has become so big and lucrative is that players are literally bred, like we do with our beef, to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And as a result of that, that has trickled down to the high school level, and that's why the science has finally caught up. That's why it's an appreciably different game today in 2014 than it was even 20 years ago. So weight limits would make sense. Pushing for a sensor to be put into helmets so that we could gauge how many G's a player is taking. What you have to do is build in an incentive that is different than the current one that exists, which is money and winning. Those are the two incentives that rule the game at every level. What you would have to do is build in a different set of incentives. So coaches would have to pull a player out or order that player to stop leading with his head, because they would have to pull him out of the game if he had a certain number of G's, if the monitor in his helmet registered a certain number of G's. These things could happen tomorrow.
It's sort of the way you would bench a basketball player who had too many fouls, right? I'm treading in
yes,
area
but,
there.
But yes,
because you don't want that person... I mean, if you...
Correct.
You could almost say, there's a limit, you've done too many of this motion.
Right. With the additional motive that the foul in this case is the injury to his
brain.
Right,
right. So it's a foul on yourself in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Another... In the back... With the glasses, yes, you, sir.
Thank you. I come from Minnesota, where it's been increasingly easy to be against football, partly because of the stadium you mentioned, but also because the Vikings haven't done very well recently.
And I feel your pain.
And it's the place where one of the biggest extra stadium stories of the last year has occurred, with Adrian Peterson
right.
and his son. And... You mentioned that that sort of thing caused people to be surprised when they, oh, dear, it's different from they're acting outside with Ray Rice and his girlfriend.
Right.
I wonder if it's a little bit different from that is sort of a way people remove themselves from the stadium and see that as a normal behavior. And so if we sanction them, or if we want the teams to sanction them for their extra stadium activity, we're really relieving ourselves of our responsibility for what is going on inside the stadium.
Yeah, I think you're right on target. So a lot of what I'm trying to write about at the end of the book, thank you for your comment, yay, go Minnesota. Look, Minnesota voted for Mondale. I love you forever. And I'm, as I say that, I'm thinking, I remember, I just had this flash of memory when I was in college when that election was happening. This is the second Reagan-Mondale election. And I could sort of see a window to the future of America because I came back disconsolate because Mondale had lost, and he had lost every state other than Minnesota. And this guy came, a hockey player.
Massachusetts.
And Massachusetts as well?
No.
Oh, no, anyway, I think he only, here's what I remember. This guy was coming down the hallway, he's a hockey player, and he goes, "Yeah, we won 570-3. And he meant electoral votes, okay? And that, I sort of made that connection of, oh, this is our culture on sports. It's a zero-sum lot. What matters is that you win. I think the way in which politics, the way in which we even view politics now is through this particular kind of lens of who's winning. Who's up in the polls? No consideration of the morality of the policies of the candidates. That's just loser stuff. It's who's winning. But the larger point about fans and how I think what the media does, since the media is basically being subsidized by football at this point, if you look at the one area of the media that is growing massively, where every other, especially the print media, every other area is contracting, sports pages, and specifically coverage of football. They have a vested interest, sometimes codified in contracts like ESPN and sometimes just incidental to their business model like the Boston Globe. They have a vested interest in our interest in football since it sells a lot of advertising for them. And for that reason, consciously and unconsciously, sports reporters tend to focus on scapegoats, figures who can make us, who can make fans feel as if they've somehow solved the moral problem of football. If we just get rid of Adrian Peterson, if we just get rid of Ray Rice, if we just get rid of Roger Goodell and bring in somebody like Condi Rice, our problems will be over. We will have dealt with. It's this idea, it's kind of a form of ablution, that as fans, we know that there's something unwholesome in this interest that we have in the game, and we want to find some moral act that we can take or advocate for. But those are really the scapegoats. And they're always intended to keep us, if you find the bad apples, you don't have to consider whether the orchard is diseased, would be the way I would put it. And that's what my book is trying to suggest. It's not one player, it's a whole system.
In the blue shirt, right in front of the, yeah, right there.
I'd like to sit down with you for an hour and discuss this, but I'm going to keep it quiet, quick, because you've, a lot of the stuff that you've mentioned is so interesting. I really respect what you're saying. However, I just want to make a couple of quick comments.
Sure.
Number one, I've known a lot of people who love football for the physicality of it. And
yep.
They're very decent people.
Me too.
Right.
Yep.
Secondly, my father got him through college. I know that's a cynical view, what you were saying, that it's a way to through college. However, it has worked for some people.
Yep.
My father was a very good student. It was many, many years ago.
Absolutely.
I wanted to mention that.
Yep. Yeah.
But a couple of other things. And I do respect what you're saying, but however, many other sports have problems.
Yes, they do.
Gymnastics has serious orthopedic problems when it gets very serious.
Yep.
MMA and boxing. MMA is growing unbelievably.
Yeah.
And look how violent that sport is.
Yeah.
Soccer with the headers, the concussions that causes.
Right.
They should probably ban headers.
Sure.
Baseball with the beanball. Yep. Hockey with the fights and the concussions. There's a lot of problems with other sports.
Yes.
Too.
So those are great points, and I appreciate your being kind in your concerns. Your dad was great as a student, and that's fantastic, and it can be a path out, just like you can safely play it. The point I would make is he didn't have to be. You don't have to be. They don't bring a kid to Alabama or Michigan or Texas, which, by the way, used to be universities and are now football teams in your mind, okay? I can say those. That's supposed to be an academic institution, and you think of a football team. That's how deep it is. But they don't have to be. Really, what they have to do is be ready on game day. That's the incentive system. I think it's fantastic that he found that path, and I think that still happens. And there are guys who do wonderfully because they find football a way to channel their aggression and so forth. But we only see in this culture the winners. That's the way it works here. We only see the winners. We see the rich people, we see their boats, we see their beautiful food, we see their houses, and we see the athletes who succeed and do well. what we hide from ourselves, and I think the media insulates us from, are the people who are aren't the winners. The people who never make the pros but have invested everything of themselves and their bodies and maybe even their minds in that dream. Or who get an injury, and suddenly, where are they? They haven't prepared themselves for a full life. The average player's life is going career is going to be over in his mid-20s. That leaves a lot of time, right?
And if they don't have an education, then they have, in fact, nothing.
And in fact, if their whole sense of worth in the world resides in being able to play a game they can no longer play, that's a tough thing to carry. Again, you have to be honest about why somebody's being valued. It doesn't have to do with the content of their character. As for the other sports, we don't disagree. The reason that, I mean, you're essentially making the same point I'm making. I'm interested in football because I played it. A couple of those concussions I talked about were playing football, tackle the pill, whatever. And I still wanted to go out and play more. I felt that same buzz of adrenaline, the leverage, the momentum, the sudden possibility. It absolutely gets you charged up. You know, that's not proof that it's noble. It's proof that you have a limbic system, if you know what I mean. It's proof that you're alive, and your body is, you know, the body at play is an ecstatic thing. And I guess my objection is not to the game itself. If my son wanted to play, and even if he wanted to play tackle, I'd say go ahead. I'd be a little worried, but you can't insulate people from risk, especially kids. Sometimes, to some extent, they need to realize the world's dangerous and also that they get hurt and survive. But around that beautiful game has grown up this huge, utterly cynical industry, and that has infiltrated our educational system, and that I think has affected our civic lives and the way that we perceive gender and race. And you know, that's really kind of what the book is trying to dig into. It is an attempt to initiate that conversation.
Let's have the gentleman in the red shirt, and then afterwards behind the woman on the aisle.
I started playing football 65 years ago through to college later. And at that time, our tackles weighed 220 pounds.
Yeah.
Natural weight, I think. Mm-hmm. We only practiced. We didn't have a weight room. Our workouts were calisthenics, we call it. And then we played.
Right.
A practice. Now I'm glad I'm not playing now, because these people are giants and they're bound to kill each other. But what I'm concerned about is the human nature of it all. That when I was growing up, they're talking about banning boxing.
Right.
Now people, you know, as you say, get excited about a big hit. What a wonderful hit. And I cringe, even though I played. I cringe when I see, you know, Wes Welker.
Probably because you played, you cringe.
I only had maybe one strange concussion, but what I'm concerned about is that people enjoying that, and hockey cannot get rid of the fights, really. People, that's hockey, you know, and that's what
they really could, but it's too profitable.
Yeah, but because people like it.
Right.
And so instead of banning boxing, we now have cage fighting. And what it all adds up to me, is, and I don't know if it's just male, I don't know about how women feel, but that there is this nasty side of masculine human nature that really likes violence, that you know, thinks before they go to war that war's great, and cage fighting, which is horrible. Guys, you know, on the ground being pummeled.
Right.
That makes me cringe. So you can play and still feel, as I did, that, you know, you don't want anybody hit that.
I got you. Yeah, I'll just say quickly on that, you know, I hear this a lot, and I think my book is in some ways an attempt to grapple with the fact that I have those impulses, and that I came from a family that was very violent emotionally, psychologically, and physically. You know, I remember coming home from walking our dog and seeing my twin brother with a carving knife, wielding it like Tony Robbins in Psycho, and my mom behind him. She was like, by this time we were way bigger than her, and my older brother's in the garage with the door locked, and my twin brother wanted to stab him because my older brother had stabbed him and drawn blood with a fork. So I guess it was like a cutlery thing, and he's like, I'm going after you with a knife. That wasn't happening all the time, but it was in the ecosystem. And I understand and agree with you and feel those same angry, out-of-control impulses. But what I always defer to, or what I have to keep in mind, and maybe it comes from having little babies in my house now, moral progress is inconvenient, but it is also possible. Among the other arrangements that Americans consent to, along with MMA and football's our most popular sport, and a continuous cynical arrangement with sending off young men to war and not dealing with their psychological or physical disfigurement when they come home, which is exactly our attitude towards football players, by the way. Among the other arrangements that we as a culture have come to is that women should have the vote, and that human beings shouldn't be treated as property, and that it is the right thing for people, regardless of their sexual orientation or their physical ability, to have equal rights under the law. We did that, actually, with considerable resistance. You want to tell me we don't have the gumption as a country to curb our appetites for an excessively violent, crazily greedy sport? Come on, that's bullshit.
There was, with the glasses, and this will have to be our last question, I'm afraid.
This doesn't actually have anything to do with football.
That's fine. I think people have heard just enough about football.
Since I'm a writer, I wanted to ask, who was the agent who didn't want to pay you? if you can tell us.
It's online. I forget his name, conveniently. If you look online and look at, like, Steve Almond agent pay or dispute, you can find it. I printed our email exchange. So
maybe we have time for one more question. Yes, here in the front row. And the mics have run away, but if you shout,
okay,
I don't know, here she comes.
Here she comes.
Here she comes. This will be the last question.
Quick comment and a question for
And
you.
I will be happy to answer questions or receive rotten fruit or whatever it is afterwards. Okay.
As a writer, I love that you insist on getting paid when there's an economic arrangement, and it always bewilders me that writing, which is not only a profession but also an art, people will pay thousands of dollars for a painting or a sculpture,
right,
but object to something written.
Right.
My question, which goes back to football, if you had football as part of your life for so many years and from such an early state, was there a particular moment or event that you had that suddenly prompted you to start looking at it?
Yeah, there is, and I want to just grab the book real quick, I think I can get through this because I wrote it all down. And it's not until the very end of the book that I write about this because, I don't know, I didn't want to foreground it in that way. But I do want to read about it because it's, I think, what happened. So two summers ago, my mother began to show more pronounced signs of cognitive decline. In July, she fell on her way to see a patient. She's a psychoanalyst and tumbled into a state of delirium. She wound up in an intensive care unit at Stanford Hospital. My wife had just given birth to our third child, but my brothers worried that mom might be dying, and my father admitted that he could use some help. By the time I arrived, my mother's condition had deteriorated. She swung between benign confusion and extreme disorientation. Often she had no idea where she was and virtually no short-term memory. At one point, she asked where her mother had gone. She insisted that she was in the midst of an awful dream and stared in bewilderment at the IVs taped to her arms. Her face was deeply bruised from the fall. She could not feed herself. When doctors asked her basic questions, "Do you know what year it is, Dr. Almond?" she looked at them imploringly. One night, as I tried to explain to her for perhaps the 10th time that she could not go home yet, she looked at me in panic. "Something terrible is happening to me," she said, and began to weep inconsolably. It was a moment of appalling lucidity. She could see, if only for a few drowning seconds, the true nature of her circumstance. Doctors talk about the brain as a mystery. What I realized in those sorrowful days is how holy the brain is. It is a temple that houses our fragile selfhood. We think, therefore we are. But if we cannot think, no matter how vigorous the body, we vanish. As it turned out, my mom's brain had fooled the docs. Her episode was an acute dementia, apparently triggered in part by medication. But no one can come face to face with dementia and look at football in the same way. At least I couldn't. That was the moment where the stories that you read sort of in the abstract suddenly became real, and that was the trigger for me to start investigating all these other aspects of the sport and, you know, me as a fan of the sport. What I would say about the weird thing about putting this book into the world is it makes you realize, and this is related to your question about writing, how much we have come to assume that things are free in this culture. And because the internet has made stuff free and because football is free to us, we just assume it's just everything should be free. And it is, it's in a veiled way, I think it winds up degrading what writers are trying to do, that they're essentially going in search of themselves and hopefully along the way telling stories that other people, that make other people feel less alone.
I think that's a wonderful place to end our session. Thank you for your questions and for coming. Thank you to Steve.